Kids, they are resilient, but mental health experts warn that youth and teens are suffering disproportionately and that depression and suicide rates are on the rise. It's a conversation about youth mental health and well-being here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers at Stanford studied the brain scans of teens. They said in a report last month that virtual learning and social distancing have cut off teens from a major means of psychological support, and that puts them at higher risk for anxiety and depression. Teens, we want to hear from you. How are you doing? Parents, how are you helping them through these challenging times? What questions do you have about changes in your relationship? We're at 800-642-1234. Licensed clinical psychologist Stephen Dykstra directs the mobile crisis team for Wraparound Milwaukee, providing care and interventions for children with emotional, behavioral, and mental health needs. Stephen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with Wraparound Milwaukee. Can you tell us about what your group does and the efforts there?
So Wraparound Milwaukee is a publicly administered network of both public and private agencies that provide mental health care across a wide spectrum of need, everything from you need us to come to your house one time and help you solve a crisis and we never see you again, that's the crisis team that I've been involved in for years, to much more in-depth care that may last years and be coordinated across multiple agencies for people who really need that. The real revolution of Wraparound Milwaukee, and Wraparound is an approach to care that you can find in a number of communities, and Milwaukee is a leader in it, is that we want to care for kids as close to their home, as close to the community as possible. We want to provide them with the care and support they need without disrupting the rest of your life. We want to get away from an older model of care that said, oh, you need help, go away someplace. We'll send you away someplace for 6 months or a year, in the past 5 or 10 years, until you're ready to come back to your family, come back to your school. That was a terrible idea for anybody, but particularly for children. And Wraparound is a nationally and internationally leading way of getting away from that model of care.
So you've really tried to reduce the number of institutional-based care or residential treatment center inpatient-type care protocols.
Yeah, absolutely. And not because those are bad things, just because they're not the most effective way to care for children under most circumstances. We still use hospitals, we still use residential care facilities, but where we used to use them for years, we use them for months. Where we used to use them for weeks, now we use them for days.
So who is in your crisis team? Can you kind of give us a little idea of how you work?
So our crisis team, which is currently called the Children's Mobile Crisis Team, CMC or CMCT, is a mixture of clinicians of various backgrounds. Over the years, we've had nurses, social workers, licensed therapists, people in training to become social workers and licensed therapists, so people who have master's degrees or other college degrees and who may be in the process of moving along that chain of qualification. We've had psychiatry residents and fellows, postdoctoral fellows study with us. We have psychologists and psychology interns and fellows who studied with us and worked with us. And what they do, the best metaphor for it is probably a mental health fire department. So you imagine a fire department where people are standing at the ready, they're ready, you call, they respond to you, however you need, whatever you're going to need. And so this is essentially a mental health fire department that's ready to respond. It's a little different in the sense that we may know something about you already. You may be on our system. We may have talked to you before. We may have responded to you before. Before the pandemic, a lot of our calls were responses to schools. Children, not surprisingly, when school is in session, a lot of their mental health crises, their behavioral crises can occur at school and during those hours of the day. And so we would respond there, but we also respond to foster homes, group homes, personal homes. I've responded to children in stores, shopping malls, parking lots, wherever the need is. And what that does is that avoids the need to snatch that child up and take them from there in order to deal with the crisis, because too often that means the police.
Would,
it's not that the police are bad, but it's just that we don't want to involve them if we don't need to.
Would emergency dispatchers dispatch you in some of those instances where it's not happening inside the home?
In some future state, maybe.
Okay.
Right now, people call us directly.
Okay.
We have our own phone number. People call us. We answer that phone number 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We're much more mobile and available to you at 3 o'clock in the afternoon than we are at 3 o'clock in the morning, as you can imagine. But we don't get a lot of crisis calls on children in the middle of the night. And usually people don't necessarily want you to come to their home. They just want to know they can be first in line at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. There may be a future in which we are dispatched by the same emergency numbers that dispatch police and fire and other kinds of services, but we're not there yet.
We're talking with licensed clinical psychologist Stephen Dykstra, who leads the Child Mobile Crisis Team for Wraparound Milwaukee, providing care and interventions for children with emotional, behavioral, and mental health needs in their families. You can join in with your questions. Do you know a child or a teen, a young person struggling with mental health challenges through the pandemic? Have you been able to connect with resources? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So what constitutes a crisis? What no crisis, of course, is the same, but I would imagine that you would receive some pretty similar patterns out there.
Well, you know, the classic crisis is somebody who's so sad, so depressed, so anxious, so miserable, so distressed that they're starting to think about or maybe act on the impulse to harm themselves or harm somebody else. But the way people respond to their distress, to their depression, to their anxiety varies a lot from person to person. Some people act out. Some people begin to think more than they have before about harming themselves. Some people sort of freeze up and just stop functioning. Over the course of my career, I don't go on the crisis calls so much anymore, but for the 14 or 15 years that I did, that was my full-time job. The range included everything from, you know, kids who just refused to go to school, wouldn't get out of bed, hadn't gotten out of bed for several days. I once saw a young man who had been in his room coming out only at night when the rest of the family was asleep. He had been in his room for 6 years.
Wow.
A child who had succumbed to really severe mental illness, who had been in his closet for a couple of days and was afraid to come out because he was afraid that there were people out to get him. Lots of calls to school, lots of calls to stand side by side with the police to help sort these things out. In Wisconsin, statutes give police the authority to force people in serious life-threatening situations, to force people to submit to a psychiatric evaluation. Different states do it differently. In Wisconsin, that decision runs through sworn police officers. And police officers in Milwaukee County know that they can call us. And we have an adult team, too. And our adult team works very closely with the police because the police know they're not the best people to make that decision in many cases. And so while they have the authority to make the decision, we stand next to them while they make that decision.
We're talking with licensed psychologist Stephen Dykstra about the stress that youth and teens are experiencing 7 months into this pandemic. Do you worry about a teen who seems withdrawn or angry? What have you done to reach out to them? Have you sought out counseling for a young person who is experiencing mental health challenges? Can you get access to counseling? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at youth and teen anxiety and depression here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Studies are underway on teen mental health during the pandemic. Mental health experts worry about a spike in depression and suicide as young people are increasingly cut off from their peers and caring adults who can help. parents of teens, how is your young adult coping with staying at home? Have you sought ways they can spend time with friends and stay safe? Are you worried about them becoming more withdrawn, more irritable, or hopeless? What questions do you have about resources and next steps? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We have licensed clinical psychologist Stephen Dykstra, who's with Wraparound Milwaukee, and he stays with us. So, Stephen, how has the pandemic affected the mental health of the young people and the people you work with?
Well, it's affecting everybody. It's affecting me. It's affecting you. It's affecting everybody. We are social creatures. We are not, most of us, well-designed to live in isolation from other human beings. My wife said at some point in a few months into the pandemic, she just declared one day, "I didn't know I liked people this much." You know, we take it for granted that we are around people, that we stand in lines with people, that we pass by people, even if we're not having deep interactions with them. And when you take that away, that's a different circumstance for human beings. It's a different context for us to live our lives. I think it pays to step back and really acknowledge for a minute that being connected to other people is an essential thing that human beings do. We are designed that way. I wouldn't put it on the same level as breathing, but it's close. We are really wired up for that. And when you take that away from us, when you remove us from that, that changes things. And one of the other things that happens, and this is in our lives, but also the lives of children, is we take for granted all the things like school, work, shopping, just going through our daily lives that provide us a certain amount of social contact without making any special effort to seek it out. And when we take those things away, we lose all that. And the only way to make up for it is to make a really deliberate special effort to fill in that gap. And we're not used to doing it deliberately. It used to just happen. It's like the difference between breathing naturally without thinking about it and having to tell yourself you need to breathe.
So what types of deliberate efforts can we make with a young person, a teenager, an adolescent in these times?
I think we need to make sure that they're staying connected both face-to-face and virtually whenever they can. I think we need to make sure that they're talking with their friends, that they have connections to their friends. You know, there's still some good weather left, that they have a chance to meet with people face-to-face at an appropriate social distance. You know, if they couldn't have, if they used to get together with five or six friends to watch a movie or play a game, can they get together with one? We can't do what we did before, but can we do a version of what we did before? Socially safe, you know, pandemically safe, socially distanced, with lots of hand sanitizer and masks and all that kind of stuff. But what can we do? What's possible? Can we meet outside? You know, our teams, the teams that I work with beyond even the crisis team, one of the things we recognize is that sometimes meeting with people virtually just isn't enough. Mm. We need to meet with them face to face. And sometimes that means through a screen door. Sometimes that means on the porch or out in the front yard. I've met with people in parks because that's safer. We have to make responsible decisions and be as responsible as we can be. But we also have to acknowledge this social connection and human contact. And I don't mean necessarily physical human contact, although sometimes it means that. But just human social contact is an essential thing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Stephen Dykstra, who's a licensed psychologist, director of the Child Mobile Crisis Team with Wraparound Milwaukee. We're discussing youth mental health, including anxiety, depression amid the pandemic, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Chris now, joining us from Three Lakes. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Two quick comments. The first one is, I think when the adults in a society can't agree on a common reality, it's really hard for the young people to look to them for leadership. And so they're trying to make sense of the world, and nobody is making sense in a way that they understand. And the second thing is rites of passage. A lot of young people are missing these key things that help mark their journey to adulthood, like graduation, prom, spring break. These things, you know, they're getting to everything here has an asterisk by it, and that's going to lead to a lot of problems here in a couple years.
Chris, thank you for those observations. Stephen, first with rites of passage, what do you see there in terms of that impact when we can't hold those traditional ceremonies?
They're the kinds of things that kids might tell themselves beforehand, it's either a big deal or it's not a big deal. But when you can't have it, when you can't do it, it does sort of, you know, rites of passage are things that mark important points in our lives and also connect us to our culture and to our society. They're ceremonies and moments we all pass through that we share with each other. You know, most of us have certain experiences in common, first times of things that we can talk to other people about. And to take those away from people kind of creates, it deflates life a little bit. It contributes to sort of the increasing blandness of life, of every day flowing into each other. I think I'm probably not the only one who sometimes struggles to remember which day of the week is it. Is it Monday? Is it Wednesday? You know, and because every day sort of runs into every other day and becomes more and more the same.
Yeah, and I noticed too, my kids continue to ask me, like, what day, do I have a Zoom today, which was Sunday? No, it's not a school day today. And so I can see what you're saying there with the days blending together.
Yeah, we're not as anchored. We're not, you know, we're not disoriented, but we're not quite as well-oriented as we used to be. You know, we're a little less solid in kind of where we are and what's the flow of things. Because there are fewer things to sort of mark the passage of time and to mark our progress through society and through the community. You know, if you were a middle school kid in the spring and now you're a high school kid, that used to mean you went to a different building. You were surrounded by different students. You still have different teachers showing up in your Zoom link, but you're doing it from the same chair, from the same desk at home as you did before. There's much less of a sense that you've made that passage from middle school to high school. And that's taking something away from children. By itself, it may not seem like very much. But as the caller points out, there's multiple rites of passage which are going by the wayside. And when you add them all up, it becomes something.
When youth hear conflicting reports on the pandemic or not getting a clear message, what can that do to their attitude and their behavior?
Well, I think it gives them some license to just kind of do whatever they want, which is not a good idea, to take risks that they shouldn't take. I think the bigger problem, and this shows up in the area of school, is while adults, and I put adults in quotation marks there, while adults were debating things which should not have been debated, while adults were arguing about things that were really inarguable, we were not spending our time and energy answering much deeper and more complex questions. You know, the question about what to do about schools and could schools open and could we get good data, which we should have been able to get, and could we open schools? Would it be different for young children than for older children? We didn't do that. You know, the fall came and those questions came up as though they just sort of dropped from the sky in the middle of August. Well, if you were paying attention, you knew back in March and April that this day was coming, that we would have to make this decision. We were so busy arguing about whether people should wear masks and how often they should wash their hands and all those sorts of things. It should have been a done deal. There wasn't a lot of political and social energy and commitment to answering really much more complex questions. So what we have now is schools, one school's doing it one way and one school's doing it another way, which is probably good because we're doing an experiment to find out what works and what doesn't. But we should have had better data and we should have had better answers, and we really let our schools and our communities and our teachers down because of that.
With students spending so much time in virtual learning, and then there is social media, what effect does the social media layer have on them?
Well, you know, we've been concerned, those of us who pay attention to these things have been concerned for a while. So for a number of years, there's been a steady alarming, not overly dramatic. It's not like things doubled or tripled, but they went up by a couple, by more than, you know, 10 or 15 or 20% in not only suicides amongst young people, which remain fairly uncommon, but also serious suicide attempts, and that children survive, but the attempts are still defined as serious. Those have also gone up, and they've gone up pretty solidly across the country. There's some variability between places and from year to year, but it seems pretty steady and pretty reliable that this really happened. And that was even before COVID. It's very difficult to discuss that and not speculate. And it's just speculation.
And let's pause there with clinical psychologist Stephen Dykstra, who is with us as we check in on the mental health and well-being of our youth and teens. He leads the Children's Mobile Crisis Team for Wraparound Milwaukee. Are the issues of our era troubling your teen? Let's talk about it, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. The COVID-19 crisis has taken a psychological toll on everyone. We're focusing on how it's affecting teens and youth here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stanford researchers found that teens who showed greater connectivity or interconnectedness in particular brain regions were less likely to experience pandemic-related depression and anxiety. How has your teen adapted to these times? Is your family going through a trauma, a death of a loved one? How is your young person mourning? Do they fear for their family's finances or more loss to come? Let's talk, 800-642-1234. We have licensed psychologist Stephen Dykstra, who directs the Mobile Crisis Team for Wraparound Milwaukee, and he's our guide. Stephen, let's pick up on the point you were making about social media. How is it affecting young people?
Well, we're learning more about it all the time. So some of what I'm going to say is speculation, but I think it's reasonably well-informed speculation. We are not designed, we are not evolved as social human beings to have 800 or 1,000 Facebook friends, and I'm putting that in quotation marks, many of whom we don't actually know. That we've never sat in their kitchen, we've never played with them when we were growing up, we don't know their family, we don't have anybody else deeply in common. Evolutionarily speaking, in the way our brains respond, that's not a friend. We are really designed and wired to have a much smaller number of real friends, what we would call true friends. You know, social media encourages us to go in a direction which does a lot of really good things. You know, I'm reconnected to people who I would otherwise not be connected to. But in the best cases, those are people who I have long, deep, personal, face-to-face friendships with. Now they just live on the other side of the country, the other side of the world. So it gives me a chance to be connected with them. That's for me. I lived most of my life without social media. I had that well established before social media came and, you know, and I say this sort of humorously, infected my life. What if you never had that? What if social media arrived in your life at a very early age and you didn't have 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years of building more typical, natural friendships and
relationships,
before you added a layer of social media on top of it. Instead of social media being a layer of your social life, it's the foundation of your social life. That's a very different thing.
Let's take a call now. Bill is joining us from Onalaska. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I was just wondering about this. I hear many times us, you know, worrying a lot about young people who are feeling very bad, being isolated from other young people. And yet I also know that young people in the past, an example might be, you know, live very, very separately. Examples might be the young people who lived on the plains, you know, in the sod huts, like we might think of when we read Giants in the Earth. Or the kids in Mongolia who live way out in the middle of nowhere with just their family. And they have, you know, no contact with other young people, and once in a while, maybe at the festival. And why is it we worry so much about it's just another adaption, and people have to make adaptions through their whole life.
Yeah, Bill, thank you for that. And, you know, Stephen, why can't we just adapt? Why can't we adapt to this isolation?
We are adapting, and different people are adapting with different levels of success. And some people, as the caller points out, are adapting quite well. But some percentage, when we're asking, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of people worldwide to all adapt at one time, some people aren't. And, you know, the other thing to point out is that folks who, you know, not everybody who went to live in the sod huts on the plains of what are now Nebraska and Kansas did well with it. A lot of people went out there and couldn't take it and came back. They returned to the city or, you know, tragically just didn't make it. So it was a real survival of the fittest kind of exercise. Could you survive these circumstances? For the kids who were born there, that's the reality they always knew. I'm familiar with the culture he talks about, some of these Mongolian tribes people and nomads who live really remarkably isolated lives. But for those children, they have always lived those isolated lives, and they are surrounded by people who have, you know, the few people in their lives who have always led those isolated lives and can guide them and coach them through it. We now have millions worldwide, billions of people who are leading deeply, richly, socially connected lives, being coached and guided by people who had lived those same kinds of lives through their whole existence, who are now flung into a completely different circumstance in the company of people who are also flung into a completely different circumstance, and none of them know what the hell they're doing.
We're talking with clinical psychologist Stephen Dykstra, who leads the Child Mobile Crisis Team for Wraparound Milwaukee. And we're discussing child and teen mental health challenges amid the pandemic and taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Lisa now in Madison. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. I was wondering if you were familiar with the work of California's Surgeon General, Nadine Burke-Harris. And also following on that, I would love to hear your thoughts on kind of measuring childhood trauma via the ACE, Adverse Childhood Experience Score, and how we can all become more trauma-informed.
All right, so a question about trauma-informed care from Lisa. Stephen, go ahead.
I'm not familiar with the work from the California Surgeon General, exactly what the caller is talking about, but I'm very familiar with the ACE, or what's sometimes called the ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale. And there's two Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale, that is, that tries to measure exposure really on a population level, not so much on an individual level. It's a good measure for looking at 1,000 people, 100,000 people, and seeing what the trends are, how many adverse childhood experiences there are. And it's a very simple scale. And it started out in middle and upper middle class Southern California. It was a scale that was developed and first put up by Kaiser Permanente when they realized from the data that a lot more of their kids than they realized had had adverse childhood experiences. And the kids who had had more adverse childhood experiences, particularly who had passed a certain level of childhood experiences, had different outcomes in their life. They used more health care. They were less likely to graduate from high school. They were more likely to get in trouble. They were more likely to feel sad. They were more likely to need mental health care, more likely to be taking psychiatric drugs than kids who had had fewer adverse childhood experiences. This was an eye-opening thing because this wasn't just kids from neighborhoods where we think adverse childhood experiences are much more common. When they tried to carry the Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale into an urban area, I believe it was Philadelphia, they had a problem because there were 10 questions, and so many of the kids were scoring 8, 9, and 10, scores that were rare where the ACE first came up, that they had to come up with the urban Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale, where things like your father lost a job, or you had to move and lost your friends, or you know a parent died or something like that, were replaced with things like somebody you know has been shot and murdered. a gun has been pointed at you and you thought you were going to die. Questions more like that. Because if you ask the ordinary middle-class ACEs, kids in those neighborhoods all had, mostly had all of them.
What has the effect been with having the scales or the two scales of ACEs in terms of treatment and in terms of resources?
The biggest thing is it's opened our eyes. And when I talk about trauma, and I talk about trauma pretty often, one of the things I want to emphasize is we were not blind to trauma before the ACEs. We were not blind to trauma before somebody coined the term trauma-informed care. What we were kind of blind to was the low-grade, lower-level, and moderate traumas that repeat over and over and over again. We were sort of blind to how deeply affected children and communities were by sort of chronic, non-spectacular traumatic stress. You know, the kinds of kids I used to work with who had suffered really severe trauma, torture would not be too strong a word for what many of those kids went through. We were not ignorant of the idea that that's why they were having the problems they were having. You know, when I saw a child who had been tortured for the first 8 years of their life and they weren't doing well when they were nine, you know, we were not idiots. We didn't miss the fact that that's why they were not doing well. What we have sometimes missed, and we are now starting to open our eyes to, is that kids, and they tend to cluster in certain neighborhoods, unfortunately, who have been exposed to lower levels of stress. Not that they see somebody shot every day, but they're worried about seeing somebody shot more than they should be. Not that they're beaten up every day on their way to school, but they worry every day more than they should be about being beaten up on their way to school. That wears them down. That it's like the drip, drip, drip of water that just sort of wears you out and can eventually wear a hole in a thing. That's what trauma-informed care is really about, is that.
Can bullying be one of those low-grade traumas, exposure to bullying?
Yeah, absolutely. And not just being bullied, but the anticipation of bullying, about worrying at night before you go to bed, worrying in the morning when you wake up and on your way to school, worrying at school as you go between classes, not wanting to go out for recess because you're afraid you're going to be bullied. You may be bullied three or four times a year in any significant way, but if it's enough to put you over the edge to where you're anticipating bullying, you're thinking about bullying, and you're worried about bullying, and you're changing your behavior to avoid bullying, it can absolutely be the kind of thing I'm talking about.
The fear is the toxicity. We're discussing the psychological state of our children 7 months into this pandemic and what to do to support our youth. Milwaukee County clinical psychologist Stephen Dykstra is with us. Has your child experienced instances of bullying in the virtual classroom? How was it handled? Are the support networks they had pre-COVID still there for them? What resources has your school offered? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Stephen Dykstra here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with a licensed psychologist, Stephen Dykstra of Wraparound Milwaukee. We're talking about the effects of social isolation on our adolescents during this pandemic, what might happen with their ability to cope with emotions, and how caring adults can help. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Kathy now in Pewaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I was calling because I work with high school students, and the question I have is, once COVID hit, these kids had like spring break is how they mentally took it for the end of the last school year. And a lot of them have had problems getting their sleep patterns back on track because they'd stay up late, you know, playing video games with their friends and then not get up in the morning. Any ideas on how to help kids get their schedules back on track? Because I think that really does hurt them emotionally.
Kathy, thank you. Stephen.
It does. And there's sort of two interesting parts to this question. There's how do you get kids to sort of fit the schedule that we require of them? And then there's the question of, you know, are we requiring the right schedule of them? And that debate has gone on for years. We know that kids in that age group developing adolescent brains seem to be better designed for sleeping late, waking up late, staying up late. That's not just something they do to avoid us. They maybe are designed that way, that their brains sort of like that. We're not going to change the schedules of schools, based on this conversation. But, I think she's right that kids treated this as a sort of an extended spring break because that's the only model they had for what they were going to. Oh, I'm not in school. If I'm not in school, I'm out of school. Spring break. And it was in, we were asking them to do something they've never done before. When I talk to folks about sleep, one of the things to keep in mind is that sleep is often the first, sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle symptom that goes along with depression and anxiety and mental illness. If you look at a list of signs and symptoms of various forms of mental illness, sleep is there for all of them. Some kind of disruption of sleep is common. It's also true, that's not to say that everybody whose sleep is disrupted is showing a sign of mental illness. It's also true that people whose sleep has been disrupted makes them more vulnerable to mental illness. Sleep is very important to us. It's important to the health of our body and of our mind. What we're getting into here is a category of expertise. It's called sleep hygiene. That is how we sleep, how we get ready to sleep. One of the most important things for kids is to turn off the TV, turn off the music, turn off the video game half an hour, maybe an hour before they're planning to go to bed. It's very hard to go to bed straight from playing an exciting video game or watching a dramatic video on YouTube, so even if it's humorous, and then just laying your head down and sleeping. It's just, we're not designed to do that.
The brain's still very active with what just happened.
Right, so you have to wear down. You know, ideally, and this goes for adults too, bedrooms and beds in particular would be places that we went just for sleep. So we wouldn't sit on our bed playing video games for 6 hours because then our mind says, what, you know, when we go to bed, am I going to bed to sleep or am I going to bed to play video games for 6 hours? We would do that in another place on another piece of furniture in another posture. So that can help. The other thing is sometimes getting our sleep worked out means having a few bad days. It means getting up. You know, it's hard to make somebody go to sleep. It's hard to make ourselves go to sleep, but we can make ourselves get up. And that can be the impetus towards rewiring our sleep. The other thing that's important is if you get up, you start getting up early to try to rebuild your sleep cycle, you're going to be tempted to nap at 2:30 in the afternoon. Don't. Stay awake, whatever you have to do, stand on one leg, you know, tap yourself on the forehead, whatever you have to do to stay awake, so that you're able to sleep that night when you're supposed to. If you can keep that up for a few days, you can usually get back on a more regular schedule.
One of the difficulties my little ones have, my youngest have, are this notion that virtual learning isn't something that they have to get excited to get dressed up for, to go see their peers in person is much more exciting. And so the virtual learning environment, from a parent's standpoint, takes a lot more prodding to say, all right, you know, class starts at 8:30. You got to be in front of your computer. They don't really have that. They're not really compelled in the same way as if they would been would be going to hear a classroom bell and to their school with lots of children.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same sort of social quality. It doesn't have sort of mark the beginning of the day in the same way as children in the neighborhood would stream towards school together. You know, if you watched overhead with a drone, it'd be like little rivers of children gathering together until they all went in the door together. We don't have that. I wonder if we can create things like that. I wonder about things like having little rituals about the start of the day, still having school clothes. Certain clothes that you put on, it marks for you that it's the start of the school day. I wonder about the value of getting dressed up. I did some online training sessions that I recorded yesterday, and I put on a coat and a bow tie to remind myself, you know, game time, to sort of put on the uniform. I wonder if this is a time when schools might want to get creative and have specific uniforms, T-shirts or something that children wear, something they wear that says, hey, we're here, we're together, when we look at each other on the camera shots, on the little windows on the screens, that we're all wearing something, the same thing. We're all together in a way we wouldn't be together otherwise. It's small, but it's something.
We're talking, I just want to reintroduce you, clinical psychologist Stephen Dykstra, who directs the mobile crisis team for Wraparound Milwaukee. Let's bring in Rick now in Minocqua. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Stephen. Say, I just wanted to take the opportunity to compliment both you and Stephen on the extraordinary knowledge and insight he brings to this subject. And I'm a retired ER doctor. I trained at the county hospital years ago in Milwaukee. I don't know if I ever worked with Stephen, but he brings a tremendous amount of understanding of this problem. And what I've learned over my career is that we spend way too little time and energy and money on mental health. Mental health is not confined to just people who have problems. It's really all of our lives, and it requires a lot more time, effort, and commitment than we give. And I just wanted to compliment both of you on having this discussion. It's really extraordinary.
Rick, thank you so much for bringing
thank
that.
You so much.
Yeah.
If I can interject real quickly, and I think he sort of leads me into something that I think is a really important point. I heard a really world-renowned psychiatrist in the summer of 2019, when we were still seeing each other face-to-face, say something really important, and that was that mental illness is not the opposite of mental health. You can have a mental illness and still be relatively mentally healthy. That is, you live with the illness, you cope with the illness, you manage the illness well, you're still mentally healthy. It's also possible for your mental health to be challenged and not have any terribly spectacular mental illness, that they are really different things. It's sort of like you can have diabetes and still be quite healthy. You can be very unhealthy and not have any specific diagnosable illness. It's the same way on the mental and behavioral side.
As we close here, any words of encouragement and hope that you can offer us as we work with our teens and our young people every day?
Yeah, I think we have to strike a balance, and I think we're learning to strike a balance between adapting to the new reality and giving in to the new reality. So fighting back against it, I think, is important, but also adapting to it at the same time, fighting back against it responsibly. You know, I think people are spectacular. I really do. I think people and human beings, children, adults, old people, I think people by and large are really spectacular. While sometimes they're a little disappointing and they let us down, overall, over time, they're really quite remarkable. And I do believe that we're figuring this out, and we will figure this out. And there will come a day when all of us, billions of people around the world, will be able to come back out of our homes and gather together again. And I hope we value each other more than we did beforehand.
Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was psychologist Stephen Dykstra, director of the Child Mobile Crisis Team at Wraparound Milwaukee. If you or a loved one is in crisis, need help, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. This is the Ideas Network.